While America was shocked to learn of Germany putting people into concentration camps during World War II, we put people in camps as well. Japanese Americans, by presidential order, were rounded up and taken to internment camps in several parts of the country, primarily in the West. Tule Lake in our region was home to one of the camps. Life inside is well documented. What happened afterward gets attention in a new book called Life After Manzanar. Manzanar was one of the camps in California's Owens Valley. The book tracks people after camp life in stories and in pictures. It is the work of two authors, Naomi Hirahara and Heather Lindquist. Naomi Hirahara writes both nonfiction books and mysteries. She won an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America and several other awards for her work. She also curates historical exhibits. Heather Lindquist writes as well and plans exhibits, including interpretive displays at the Manzanar National Historic Site. Naomi Hirahara is our guest today, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I noticed the book got a financial boost from the National Park Service. Can you talk about the process that led to its creation?
Sure. So this book was a project, a co-project of two entities. One was the Manzanar History Association, which supports the efforts of the Manzanar National Historic Site, as well as Heyday Books, which is a nonprofit publisher in Berkeley. These two groups had done a book earlier called Children of Manzanar, so this is kind of a follow-up to it. And many people, the then president of the association, she was also manager of the bookstore, and she noticed that as visitors, there's been, you know, more than 100,000 visitors that have gone through Manzanar, and many people would say, well, what happened to the people afterwards? That would be a question that came up. So they applied for a federal grant, and that funded this book. And so this is not an academic book. It's for every person who's, you know, some people who may not know that much about Japanese American history, but are curious to see and follow these people.
It is a good overview, and I should point out that there are a bunch of little sidebar stories and individual tales and tales of families and lots of pictures to help you understand that we are talking about human beings here, and this was a real wrenching change in their lives. Manzanar, what is the significance of Manzanar specifically?
It was one of the earliest camps. Most people from Los Angeles were taken to Manzanar. There were about one-third of the incarcerees in Manzanar were from Southern California. And as a result, because they were from a metropolitan area, many of them eventually returned to Los Angeles and became very active in the preservation of their history, of kind of reclaiming what had been done to them, and went on to become leaders in the redress and reparations movement, which was finally successfully signed President Ronald Reagan in 1988.
Now, I noticed at its peak, Manzanar had about 10,000 people locked up in there, not including the people who worked there, which is a significant chunk of the 120,000 people who were put in camps total. Art Hansen, who wrote the foreword in this book, was so affected by his visit to Manzanar that he changed his career focus. I wonder if you had a similar experience, Naomi.
You know, I am Japanese American, but I'm a bit of an outsider in this whole story, because my parents were actually in Hiroshima during World War II, which is another experience entirely.
Wow.
But I worked at the Japanese American newspaper Rafu Shimpo, which is still around. Believe it or not, it's been around since 1903. And I began work there after graduating from college, and that was kind of like the peak of the bill had just been signed, and the first checks were being disseminated. So our newspaper played a role in finding, locating former incarcerees, as well as following the whole reparation story. And we also the past is so important, I guess, because for many decades, people were kind of silent. They were just, you know, after being released from camp, they were just concentrating on making a life for themselves and their families. Many people, you know, lost their former livelihood, so they had to become gardeners or, you know, pick up an old lawnmower and a beat-up old pickup truck and, you know, kind of start their futures all over again. So as a result of that, people didn't really talk about what happened. You know, it was only until the 1980s when through these commission hearings that people started really sharing. These Issei men would be breaking down, and in the past, some of their children had never even seen their parents show any sort of emotion. Hmm. So it was a kind of a breakthrough moment. And I think for me to watch that and to help document it as a reporter really changed me. And of course, I always thought too, if I happened to be born alive in the 1940s, I would have been locked up myself.
Right. Yeah. A big thing to notice. The terminology here, Issei was born in Japan, Nisei born here, basically
yes.
Second generation.
Yeah,
okay.
Nisei's, yeah, the children of the Issei. Mm-hmm.
You opened the book, Naomi, in November 1945 when people were still at Manzanar. We're talking, 6 months about 3 months after VJ Day anyway. Why were people still there late in the year?
Well, you know, most of the people who were the last to leave were women with children. They were the infirmed, they were the elderly. They really had nowhere to go. You know, it's one thing if you were the lucky ones to have land and to have people. And there were good people who, you know, were caretakers of that property. And as a result, those individuals could return back to their homes. But many people had nothing. And it was so uncertain. The government gave you $25 a person and a one-way bus ride. So where were you going to go? So some of these individuals, they just had babies. And in one case, their children were sick. And so they weren't really in a position to be able to move and plan their next step.
All right, $25 on a bus ticket. That's pretty amazing. Here you go. There's the rest of your life. That was the attitude as people left Manzanar and Tule Lake and all the other camps. The book is called Life After Manzanar, the work of Naomi Hirahara, our guest, and her co-author, Heather Lindquist. We'll come back and talk more about the issues that faced Japanese Americans as they left the camps after the close of World War II in just a few moments here on The Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Naomi Hirahara and Heather Lindquist have done a lot of work both in writing and in setting up historical displays to let people know what happened to Japanese Americans during World War II when 120,000 people were rounded up and taken to camps, including Manzanar in the Owens Valley of California. Their book tracks Life After Manzanar. That is the name of the book, Life After Manzanar, stories and photographs of people trying to get on with their lives after a very serious disruption of those lives, given $20 on a bus ticket leaving the camps and sent to what? That's what we'll talk about in this portion of the program. Naomi Hirahara, our guest on The Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Naomi, the $25 on a bus ticket, all right, so you can get to a place, but then what was there? What had happened to the property of most of the people who were locked up?
Well, like I mentioned, it was varied. There were some spots in the interior of the U.S. because the government really wanted the Japanese Americans to disperse, to kind of assimilate, to kind of almost disappear. One location that they were encouraging people to move to was actually Chicago, because it was a large, you know, city in the Midwest. There was jobs. But when people got there, you know, this was an issue all people faced. There was a lot of overcrowding. And this was a community city that had 400 Japanese Americans before World War II, and all of a sudden it grew to 20,000. So that presented some problems of its own. There were a lot of unsupervised young people. There was a lot of crime. You know, it was Chicago, so there was like gambling, but there was also babies born out of wedlock in the community. There was arrest of a stick-up man. So I think just all of the things that these people had suffered for the past 3 years or 2 or 3 years kind of came out and were, and yeah, as they were trying to struggle to find their place in American society. So there was a lot of people were sent to areas where there were maybe, you know, maybe to continue their education, which was a positive thing. But in some cases, they might have been the only Japanese American in their school or even the town. There was one woman who shared in this small town in Massachusetts that, you know, all the girls in her dormitory stayed up till late at night because they had never seen a Japanese American before. And she said it was very spooky. But so short term, right after the war, was this diaspora all over the U.S. But little by little, people started to return back to their to the West Coast. And there were hostels. The Quakers were very instrumental in helping the Japanese Americans resettle. So for $1 a day, you could stay in a former church, and you know, as you regained your footing and tried to find work. There was some assistance to find jobs, but as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people turned to low-wage jobs like gardening to sustain themselves right after getting released from camp.
Are we talking like people who had to be refugees from overseas wars? I mean, were we talking about people like with MDs working as gardeners, that sort of thing?
Yeah, college graduates. But also there was a segment of our population that had served in the armed forces. So they did have the benefit of the GI Bill, and that helped some of them to continue on with their education, to buy homes, and become more stable.
Yeah, you mentioned the fact that there had been Nisei in the army in the war, which raises the question, why was there a 442nd Regiment Combat Team?
At first, the government, you know, after Pearl Harbor, all like Nisei soldiers were declared, you know, enemy aliens. So they were stripped of their weapons. You know, these are ones who are already in the U.S. Army. But when they decided to start the 100th Battalion, it actually began in Hawaii. And so many young men, there were so many Japanese Americans in Hawaii, and they were the ones who initially volunteered much more than were expected. So that kind of started the foundation of the All Nisei units. And later, people from the mainland, some of them volunteered, but many, they started a draft. And not all individuals who were in camp agreed with it. There was a large number from the camp in Heart Mountain, Wyoming, that they rejected it on constitutional grounds. They said, well, if you release, you know, us and our families from camp, we will serve. So they contested the draft, and as a result, many were sent to Leavenworth to serve a prison term. So there was this is what was so interesting about the story, is so many Japanese Americans had different responses to what had happened to them. Certain people were completely devastated. People who had lost their businesses that they had worked so hard to establish before World War II were never able to regain them. And, you know, some it got into drinking and that kind of, you know, they didn't really see that much hope for their lives. Whereas others, we have some stories about one gentleman who was drawing things on his barrack, and then he later on became a designer with Disney and, you know, was one of the creators of Scooby-Doo. So there was just such a variety, and it really depended on your station in life, your own experience, how much privilege or support that you had. And just unspooling all of that for us was really fascinating.
Us, in this sense, is Naomi Hirahara, our guest, and Heather Lindquist, her co-author of the book Life After Manzanar, that tracks Japanese Americans after life in the camps. She's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. We were talking about the dispersal of people after the camps closed and the government's efforts to get people to go to parts of the country where they hadn't lived before, in essence to be, I don't know, diluted, I guess, by the rest of the population. But you do give an account of the reception in L.A. County, where there had been a very significant Japanese population, and the way that community had changed while the Japanese Americans were gone. First of all, what was the reception like for people coming back to L.A.?
In our research, we found this government document that was titled something Terrorism Against Japanese Americans, or something like Terrorist Acts. So there were cases where, like former flower growers, as they tried to continue their former profession, the cheesecloth that shades their flowers from the sun would be set on fire. There were, you know, threats initially, but what was really interesting about Los Angeles was we have this community called Little Tokyo, and so many Japanese Americans, banks and restaurants and other things were in that community. It was totally empty. It was World War II, so in Los Angeles, our defense industry was flourishing, and we needed more people, more labor. So blacks from the Deep South were recruited to work in Los Angeles. But because of restrictive racial covenants, they had no place to live. So the authorities kind of pointed, well, look at Little Tokyo. It's empty right now. Why don't you fill it? So a huge number, from maybe 40,000 to reportedly even maybe 80,000. It was probably a little less. But blacks from the South lived there. There was kind of squeezed in. There was a lot of jazz clubs that opened up, so it was very colorful, and it added to the culture of downtown L.A. But so some people were worried with the return of Japanese Americans to Little Tokyo. It was called Bronzeville during that period of time, that there might be a race riot. But as it turns out, there was a little bit of conflict, but the California Eagle, which was a black newspaper in Los Angeles, they had been very sympathetic towards Japanese Americans, and even, you know, decided not to, you know, use ethnic slurs directed towards the Japanese in their paper. So it was relatively an easy transition in that way. Of course, people were living in places that they, you know, in downtown L.A. that they were not used to. There were farm boys who were sent to Manzanar, and then they were living in Skid Row, and they were stepping over drunks and passing prostitutes on their way to school. But one of our subjects, Hank Umemoto, said that struggle for survival was nothing compared to the barriers to being accepted by American society. Like, he was not let into a movie theater, or had to sit next to a bathroom in the train, those kind of things. So those experiences show kind of the psychological struggles that people had. So even though they were able to, you know, slowly through corporate effort, through the family support, kind of regain financial stability, there was this kind of emotional, psychic scars that were wounds that were there that needed to be healed.
I'm still fascinated by the fact that Little Tokyo was empty, became Bronzeville, and then as aircraft construction demobilized after the war, turned back into Little Tokyo over time.
Isn't that interesting?
It really is. Naomi Hirahara is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Heather C. Lindquist of the book Life After Manzanar, that is exploring what happened to people after they left the camps. 120,000 people were locked up in internment camps during the Second World War, Japanese Americans all. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Brian in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi. This is really fascinating. I can't wait to see this book. As someone who hikes around in lava beds, you know, the the thought of being put in tents in Tule Lake in the summer. Boy.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to recommend is a book called Stubborn Twig. I don't know if you've heard of it. It came out in 2008.
I love that.
It's the
book.
Story of the, the apple farmers in Hood River and their travail, you know, being interned and then returning to find that their orchards, you know, trashed basically by the local Caucasian population.
All right. Thanks for that, Brian. Appreciate that. And you've read the book, you say, Naomi.
Yeah, that was about the Yasui family. And one of them actually challenged the courts regarding the exclusion orders, and it went up to the Supreme Court. And during World War II, he, you know, got no action on it. But later there was the case was reopened in the 1980s, and it was found that there was the government had suppressed some evidence, and so Min Yasui's particular case, as well as two other Nisei men's cases, were overturned. So, yeah, it's a great book. I mean, what I think might be interesting for people in your region is just the evolution of Manzanar as a historic site.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just went to their annual pilgrimage this last weekend. And it's just amazing. I also helped with the visitor center, as you know, Heather was in charge of developing the exhibitions over there. And it's just been so exciting to see. You know, I think the people in the immediate area at first were apprehensive about it developing as a national park, for various reasons. You know, it's painful for, and when we talk about this whole issue, it doesn't only affect Japanese Americans. This is an American story.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met so many seniors who have told me that it was traumatic for them. I mean, like non-Japanese, like they were in elementary school, they had a good friend who was of Japanese descent, and all of a sudden that person was gone and nobody explained it to them, you know? So it's almost like an, you know, alien takeover. So I think this is something that we as a nation, you know, have wrestled with, and it's important for us to kind of, I talk about the psychic wounds, but I think, you know, all of us are kind of victims of it and need to kind of wrestle with it. But so the site itself, they call it a site of conscience, and that's really, I think, helped people to kind of, all sorts of people come and visit the site. It's, in addition to the exhibition area, they've been recreating these gardens that, and that's what I, you know, I'm, I mentioned gardeners because my dad was a gardener himself, so I have an affinity for that, people in that profession. But it's amazing to me that in this desolate place, and again, it may be like Klamath Falls, there's so much beauty in the distance, like the Sierra Nevadas, and it's in some ways hauntingly beautiful in some ways. But in other ways, like that dust and the winds and the extreme heat, you know, I just can't imagine like 10,000 people all grouped together and just wondering what is going to happen to us. But in this desolate place, the elders thought, you know what, we need to create beauty here. We need to create gardens here. We need to have water here. And so they started, you know, some were prominent nurserymen, and from their contacts, they started ordering plants, and, you know, and they tried their best to make it beautiful. And some people can look at that and say, oh, they were just playing around in camp. But to me, it's just the opposite. It just shows that these people weren't going to give up, you know, that they were, for the sake of the larger community, their families, young people, they were going to try to create some kind of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that contrast to me is so poignant and powerful. So I think that I know some. There's going to be a group of people going to Tule Lake at the end of June, mm-hmm. and going into the early part of July. And I'm sure that's going to be just a powerful experience for them as well.
We'll have to make sure we keep up with their travels and see if we can get a chance to talk to them, either coming or going, or perhaps both. It's necessary to remember, too, as you point out, that we may think in terms, those of us who weren't there or whose families weren't there, that, well, you know, 3 or 4 years doesn't sound that long, but nobody knew at the time how long it was going to be. It's easy for us to look back and think, well, we were only in World War II for 4 years, but the fact is that nobody had any way of knowing when we got in how long it was going to be, and nobody knew when they went into the camps how long they'd be there. I wonder, you were talking about the people who had friends who just suddenly disappeared. How much did the public really know when internment began?
You know, I that's such a good question, and that's a topic I want to explore more, too. You know, I think there was a denial of all people because, I mean, there was so much uncertainty for our whole nation as well, right? And people were going off to war, so there was just concerns about, you know, your brother or your son, your uncle, you know, what was going to happen to them. And I think the people that I talked to, they were children, you know. Mm. So I just don't think the adults were telling the children what was going on as well.
Naomi Hirahara, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, she and Heather C. Lindquist, the authors of Life After Manzanar, tracking the lives of Japanese Americans as they tried to reclaim their lives after being locked up in internment camps during World War II. We'll come back and talk more with Naomi, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take your input by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. 120,000 people taken from their homes and lives and locked up in camps for the duration of the war in most cases, including the famous Manzanar camp in the Owens Valley of California, where there is a national monument now, and interpretive displays. Coming out of that area is a book about what happened to people as they got back into life. So Life After Camp is described in Naomi Hirahara and Heather Lindquist's book, Life After Manzanar. Naomi's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join in by phone or email 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about public attitudes during the war, the fact that kids certainly didn't know a whole lot. There's certainly some evidence in the book, a pamphlet saying that these people shouldn't return after the war that you show from 1944. You do tell a story, too, of a woman allowed to move to Detroit in 1943 where the Klan was active. I mean, there's a lot of history that comes up in this book, Naomi. Naomi, there? Did Naomi leave us? All right, we're going to try to get Naomi Hirahara back on the phone. She might have thought we were done there, but we're going to keep going. Naomi Hirahara, again, is the author with Heather C. Lindquist of Life After Manzanar. Naomi writes both nonfiction books and mysteries. She won an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America and several other awards for her work. She is also in the process of curating historical exhibits, including the ones at Manzanar. Heather Lindquist is a writer as well and plans exhibits, including the interpretive displays at the Manzanar National Historic Site. So we're learning some lessons about what happened after the camps closed at the close of World War II. I mean, 120,000 people couldn't just suddenly magically go back to their old lives. In some cases, their property had been lost to them. They had to sell it rapidly or just vacate it, and it was occupied by other people, and ownership was hard to establish and to get back into their lives. And so things changed drastically for people in the days after World War II. We're talking, too, in particular about what happened in Los Angeles County, where there had been a sizable Japanese-American community in Little Tokyo. Little Tokyo was home to thousands of Japanese Americans during the days before the war. Once the federal government said it's time to get all of the Japanese Americans off the West Coast and put them into camps, Little Tokyo was vacant, more or less. And that's just as American defense industries were picking up the pace and were getting people into factories to build aircraft and other war materiel. And so So what happened was that a lot of African Americans from the southern United States moved into Los Angeles because they too were restricted in where they could move because they were African Americans, ended up moving into Little Tokyo. Little Tokyo became Bronzeville during the war. So stories like that included in the book Life After Manzanar. Naomi's back with us now. Hey, Naomi.
Hello.
I wanted to ask about a story that you tell in the book about a woman who was allowed out of the camps to move to Detroit in 1943, where the Klan was active. So there's a lot of history we're learning in the book that might not have come to fore before.
Yes. Places like Detroit, actually, because there was a lot of defense work, was probably one of the five areas where Japanese Americans moved in terms of the interior. And yes, What was really fascinating was they were moving into areas where there was a lot of race relations between whites and blacks, and here they are, Japanese Americans. You know, and that was the case with Chicago too, because one of the areas in Chicago was the South Side, where people moved in. So they were not only negotiating discrimination aimed towards them, but also in the context of larger race relations.
The governor of Colorado looms as a rare figure during this period in American history. Ralph Carr was his name. How did he respond to internment?
He was quite a remarkable person. When all the governors got together, this is even before the removal of Japanese Americans. There was some discussion: are we going to accept these people into our state? And Ralph Carr was one of the few that said, yes, you know, I want Colorado to be welcoming. And unfortunately, it didn't serve him well politically, because he was ousted from his office shortly thereafter. But that legacy, like if you go to Denver, there's a Sakura Square, and I believe there's a statue of Ralph Carr there. So to this day, there's the Japanese American community, as well as other people, really commend his position, his unpopular position that was taken during a very tense time.
How many people were able to make use of programs that allowed them out of the camps if they'd relocate to the middle of the country?
The people that utilized it the most were young people, like young adults in their 20s. There were people who had been publishers, leaders of their community, attorneys. These people are saying, I got to get the hell out of here. You know, they saw the situation and they knew that they really had to get out. So, and these are the more privileged in the community too. So those are the ones who kind of worked. One of the individuals was a newspaper publisher, Togo Tanaka, and he was one of the first to go into Chicago and establish work with the American Friends Service Committee. That's a Quaker organization, to open an office. And they were kind of like, they served to transition people out of camp. And so it was usually the 20-somethings or the 30-somethings who first left. And when they could, they would send for their, you know, parents and their other extended families. But what's interesting, you know, some stayed. We have stories of people, like there was a program with Seabrook Farms, you know, that had canned and frozen vegetables way out in Seabrook, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And so they were recruiting laborers. So many people participated in that because they just wanted to get out of camp. And most of them eventually returned back to the West Coast, but some stayed. So that's why it's so unusual. There's the Seabrook Buddhist Church. You know, there's these like remnants of communities that had been established in the 40s, you know, in all these different places.
Were the workers exploited? I mean, the fact that they were let out of the camps to work in a food factory, for example, did that make them work for less than the prevailing wage at the time, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, that's always a sensitive issue. And in fact, I think Seabrook, one of the sons, he works for The New Yorker, and he even wrote an article about that. I mean, it was quite beneficial for them to have this, you know, labor force. And when Japanese Americans arrived to places like this, again, you know, there were, like, they would go bowling and the pin boys would refuse to set the pins for them. You know, they would encounter things like that. There were ceilings, of course, that they worked as hard as they could, but they couldn't become managers. You know, those were kind of the challenges that people faced in places like Seabrook.
Let's take a call here. We have Kit in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Naomi Hirahara, the co-author of Life After Manzanar.
Thank you, Jeffrey. A great show. I wrote a book of fiction a number of years ago and did a lot of research on the camps. And the thing that shocked me was we hear about the camps, but not the fact that when these people were released, a lot of times they were given a bus ticket and $25.
Right.
And on their own, and they had lost vehicles, businesses, property, homes. They went from being professionals to domestics. And that's what really, really shocked me was that it was just, this is it. You're out. We're closing the camp. Go. And that's all I wanted to say. It's a great show, and I really appreciate the author coming out like this. This is a terrific book.
All right, thanks, Kit. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate that. So yeah, it does move people when they hear the story, Naomi. And I'm sure you've probably seen a few faces at the times you've been out to Manzanar trying to explain the exhibits to people that things happened that are hard to comprehend in today's world.
Yeah, there were also a lot of trailer parks. In Los Angeles, in Burbank, there were two in Burbank, and as well as in places like Santa Monica and other places. So, so these were like the poorest of the poor. You know, they would have to live in these trailers, and again, have to have no kitchen or those kind of things. And it was kind of like living in camp again. You know, it was, interesting for them. I think also it really depended on your station in life. I think, like your caller said, the Issei, the first generation, they were probably the most had suffered because they had worked so hard before World War II. They had, you know, you couldn't become an American naturalized citizen. That was changed in 1952. Mm-hmm. But up to that time, you know, so they were trying to, you know, build a new life in a new country, and just to have everything taken from them was so devastating for some. But I think for their children, the Nisei, so, you know, some of them will say that they had a good time in camp, you know. And I think some of that is because they were children, you know, and children are so resilient, and they can find joy in so many, you know, the simplest things. Plus, I think they were kind of sheltered from the actual financial, as well as the hardships, as well as, you know, the civil liberties infractions.
Naomi, so, I hadn't heard of Prop 15 in the election of 1946. What was the idea behind that?
Well, that was so interesting with doing this research, because usually we talk mostly about the Redress and Reparations legislation that happened in the 1980s, but every step of the way in our history after World War II, there were things that leaders had to fight. And there was something that was going on in California that was still trying to limit the advancement of minorities, you know, in the state. So, and there were other things too in terms of there were alien land laws here in California, and they hadn't been fully overturned. So an Issei, for example, could not buy property. So there was just so many different kinds of legislation that had to be challenged during the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And so I give those people a lot of credit coming out of camp and having the fortitude to not only worry about dealing with their own, you know, livelihood, but also having their eye on the larger political picture.
Sure. And I was just reading that that Prop 15 failed almost 2-1 and was the first anti-Asian ballot measure to fail in California. So that was an interesting history there. I want to ask before we go, I got about a minute left here, Naomi. It seems like as the post-war period got further along, and we got new enemies, I wonder if the Cold War ultimately provided some relief for Nikkei still experiencing discrimination.
That, you know, that's also a very fascinating approach to see the in terms of the Japanese American story, because of where we stood in terms of Russia and communism, you know, the government and other people were saying, we have to have a closer relationship with Japan, you know. And as a result of that, there was a movement to make Japan more desirable, you know, acceptable to the American public. And that's when a lot of these movies and plays of Flower Drum Song and Sayonara and those things kind of came to be.
Wow. And the book does go a lot farther into a history than that as well. And we get into the 70s and 80s when people began to talk seriously about apologies and reparations and all the other things that were done in the years after people came out of the camps. The book is called Life After Manzanar. It is the work of Naomi Hirahara and Heather C. Lindquist. Naomi's been our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.